make it here very often. I feel like it's always a little bit like a safe place to feel a little bit at home because there's lots of friendly faces that I know, and this is a very lovely community that you've got here. So thanks for having me along. For those who don't know me, my name's Jeff. As was mentioned, I worked for the Uniting Church in their social justice advocacy for about a decade, and recently I've moved over to Greenpeace. Perhaps there's an announcement I can add to the list if anybody is available on Friday, the 17th, which I think is this Friday. Then the school kids are doing another school strike for climate, and there are details you can find on the internet, but it'll be on the morning, Friday the 17th, outside Woodside's head office. And there's actually the Premier's Energy Transition Summit happening that day, which has got a number of people on the speakers list, predominantly from the oil and gas industry, which makes it an interesting dynamic to have a transition summit about. But that's what they'll be doing. And so I'll be there. Feel free to join us. And thanks for indulging me in a bit of Johnny Cash. Appreciate that. We'll hark back to that as we go along. But thanks for the readings as well. So I've actually taken them from the lectionary today. They're today's readings that a number of churches will be using. And also thank you for the acknowledging of country. And my respects also go to elders past, present, and particularly the community that I know are struggling at the moment, where the result of the referendum has hit hard. It's not unsurprising to many, but that along with things that have been going on in the juvenile justice system and many other things that are ongoing, it's never an easy time for them, and so we respect their custodianship of this place. So I won't try and draw too much in the way of theological weight from Johnny Cash, but it plays a bit of a symbolic role. And before I get too much into that, I was also invited here today, thanks to Tyson, to talk a little bit about the service that I'm involved in, the congregation I'm connected with, which happens once a month on a Sunday evening, the third Sunday of the month, at Wesley Church in the city, one on the corner there of Hay Street and William Street. And we call it Social Justice Church. And we put dots in between the words for a couple of reasons. I'll explain what that's about, but I feel like we're a little bit kindred spirits in terms of congregations because we have a number of things I think that are familiar to both. We're all busy people, and so you guys do much better. You have a service every week, where all we can muster is once a month. But we're similarly, I think, drawn to social justice issues, as the name probably suggests, for our congregation. But we put the dots in there to try and say that it's about being social, it's about being justice, it's about being church. So the social bit being, we want to be a community. We want to model inclusion. We want to be a safe place. When we talk about inclusion as well, then we're quite clear that for the LGBTIQA+ community, that means full affirmation that they're welcome. And actually, our service coming up this month is our regular annual LGBTQIA+ themed service to align with the Pride Month and Pride Festival that's happening. So feel free to come along. Check it out if you're looking for a safe place, or if you know someone that is looking for a safe place that is questioning or in the queer community that doesn't have a good association with church, then perhaps we can help to be part of that. It's also the justice bit is central for us. Because not only to talk about it and to affirm it within our own church context, but to be organized, to take action, to encourage each other to go to the rallies, to be part of like writing to ministers or whatever it is that is needed to take justice into the world. But it's also to be explicitly church. It's to say, yes, we're Christian. Because I feel like sometimes when Christians get involved in social justice, then there can be a bit of an accusation that we are somehow sliding away from what fully Christianness looks like. And we want to say we are fully Christian. We don't want to be relegated or relegating our justice work to something outside of the church. We want to bring it in and be central to who we are, because we know that that's actually fundamental to what it means to follow Christ. Plus, we don't want to allow the church generally to be co-opted by nationalistic jingoism or fear-based exclusion or manipulative coercion or any other practice or ideological framework that causes harm. We are called to be love. We are called to love first and foremost. But sadly, that's not the general association people have with the church. And I was actually, after a recent service, after the service in the evening in the city, and we go for a meal afterwards to just get a bite to eat in Northbridge. And as we're walking along, walking with a friend who's actually ordained and who had chosen to wear, because he was preaching that night, so had chosen to wear a collar, which made him very distinguishable as a minister of religion. And as we were waiting to cross the street at the traffic lights, then someone across the street, also waiting, saw that there was this priest-like figure across the way and started offering various forms of advice that was not particularly friendly, helpful, or well accepted. And I was thinking about that, as in that was not a nice experience. It was, this is my friend who's trying to do the right thing and just trying to be himself. And he should be free to be able to walk through the streets without getting abuse. And that this is not to go, oh no, we as Christians are getting persecuted, but to identify that within this person who's yelling profanities, that there's an underlying mistrust of church. There's hurt in the community that he verbalised. Other people feel it and think it. And that's not universal. But at the end of the day, we as church have got a lot of work to do. So that's part of why we've chosen to do Social Justice Church in the city, in a prominent location, because we want to be a visible, prominent presence that's central, easily accessible, to go that it can be different. Church is something other than what you may have identified, what you may have experienced. And so we want to be that central kind of flagship location that's actually offering something beautiful and restorative, to not be so retiring and unnoticeable to the world, but to be a lamp on the hill about what we know Christ is calling us to be. So in some ways, we're not so concerned with what other Christians think of us, to be honest. We are there for the wounded, for the people who are feeling outcast, who have felt hurt by church, that they can find a place of solace and restoration. We're also deliberately not on a Sunday morning so that we don't compete with other services. We want to be a sort of place that people can freely come and they don't have to perform, they don't have to do, they don't have to feel like it's a burden, and they don't have to choose between the regular congregation that they might be connected to and our community. We're trying to create a beautiful space that is welcoming and restorative, as well as challenging and inspiring, so that people do take action. I make it sound quite amazing, but it's really quite simple. We're not that flash. We're small. We're time poor, and we need assistance. Actually, we get a lot of. We often get new people coming through the door, but it's hard to help them to come back again is one thing. And so, yeah, there is a sense where we need a more of a critical mass, I think, because it's quite a big church, it's a big space. But just to have people in the pews to meet those people that are coming in that find out about us. And I often feel like at the end of the service that this was a really lovely service. This was really important words were said. And I feel like there's a bunch of people out there that would actually find this really helpful and healing, challenging and inspiring, but they just don't know about it. And so that's we have to think about how we can be better at that. But also, all that said, the service itself is not enough for me. That's not the end game. Having a nice worship space that reflects my values and theological understanding is not the point. That's not the purpose of church. What I am looking for is a way to change our world for the better. What I'm looking for is for God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. For all this stuff to have a healing point. Which brings me to our readings. We've got 10 women waiting for a wedding feast, a celebration. And we've got some who are prepared and some who are unprepared. And a bit of background context being that Matthew, the author, is writing to a Jewish audience after the fall of the Second Temple in 70 AD. So it was written a bit later than some of the other texts that we have. And in some ways, Matthew is actually typical of other Jewish writers who were writing at that time, who were trying to make sense of the fall of the Second Temple, where they're in a state of disarray and wondering, how is this? What's going to work here in terms of the ultimate thing that we're expecting to happen? That God was going to be able to provide us with an overthrow of the Romans, and now we're all scattered and the temple's gone. What's the answer? And so, Jewish writers of that time were talking about things where God will provide consolation for their suffering and vindicate them whilst also punishing their enemies on the day of judgment. And so gone is the expectation of an internal uprising that was going to overthrow, and now it's hope, this expectant hope of an external thing that God would bring upon from outside to restore justice. So Matthew, in some ways, is echoing that same kind of sentiment. But then also, Matthew's got the Christian story that is being talked about at the time, at that stage of the game, where Jesus is meant to be the one returning to bring this apocalyptic vision into being. And we see from the Thessalonians passage, which was written a bit earlier, which clearly shows that they were trying to wrestle with people falling asleep, people dying before Jesus having come back. But there's still a clear expectation in Thessalonians that this is still going to happen in our lifetimes, in this generation. For those of us who are still alive, it's still going to be imminent. Whereas for Matthew, the game has moved on a bit. And oh, hang on, we're still waiting around a bit here. Still hasn't happened. What's the story? And so the emphasis is about don't give up. Hold on to hope. Don't get distracted, even though it's taking longer than we thought. The bridegroom's been delayed. So the emphasis of there's a three series of parables that appear in this section, which are calling us all to active waiting, to expectant hopefulness. So 2,000 years on from there, what message do we take from this? Things have shifted. We've even got Johnny Cash having an attempt at trying to interpret these things. Expectant hope may have moved a bit, our understanding of what some of these texts were all about and when things are going to happen and what does it look like when these things happen have shifted, and we've had to reassess our understanding. But I think I hear a few things about what active waiting means in these three parables. So I didn't get them all to be read out because we'd be reading Bible readings for the whole time. But we have the women with their oil lamps. For them, it was about being prepared and about getting themselves properly organized. For the next one, it's the parable of the talents. So the one where the servants get given either five or two or one talent and they go away and make more money for the master, give it back, and he says, fabulous, if you've made this extra money for me, you've been proactive. But for the one who was thinking, oh, the master's a harsh bloke, I'm just going to dig it in the ground and then give it back to him, he was disappointed and said, hang on, why didn't you be more proactive? So there's a whole other sermon I could go into for that, but I'll steal away from it that parable was about being productive and being proactive in our waiting. And then the last one of that series is the sheep and the goats, and we're probably all a little more familiar with that one, where active waiting is about showing compassion and justice. This is the one where, how do I know that you've why were you accepted into the kingdom? Because you cared for me when I was naked, when I was in prison, when I was hungry, when I was thirsty. You fed me, you clothed me. So active waiting there is about showing compassion and doing justice. So I hear a message for the church today in these parables. If we believe we are called to living out the fullness of the vision of what it means to be church, to be part of making a better world where the kingdom of heaven comes to earth, we have to be more prepared, more organized, more strategic even. Not just for the defense of the church, but for those suffering as if hell has come to earth rather than heaven. In my job, working for the church on social justice campaigns, I ended up finding some very helpful allies in various parts of the world, but also in the union movement. And a key message I learned from them is don't get mad, get organized. And I like that. Funnel my fury that I feel about injustice into making the change that is needed to happen. Building alliances, building awareness, building supporter bases, building resources, working strategically to do what is actually needed to create change. Just being outraged, just wringing my hands and assuming that someone else will solve it is a recipe for maintaining the status quo at best. Here we have in our churches, in our congregations, an incredible foundational base of people power in the social capital that we have built up in our church communities. And I've seen a very few, small number of people, much smaller than this, make great change by just being prepared, being organized, getting themselves in a place where they can use their collective for greater good. This is an increasingly rare thing, but you can be more aligned with others to make an even bigger impact if we are strategic about it. I think the church is not always that strategic in that sense, and that's something I've had to learn along the way. What unions would call solidarity, we might call fellowship. But we need to think of our hands of fellowship as bonds of strength, not just of friendliness. And I think of the example of William Wilberforce, who's often touted as the hero kind of figure that made these massive changes against slavery. But we know, if we actually look at the history, then he worked very hard to build up alliances over time. He formed the Clapham sect, was apparently on 70 different voluntary societies. I don't know how he had time for these things. For various causes, he negotiated.
He had a wife.
Yes, it's absolutely true. Yeah. But there was a strategy involved. There was a deliberateness to building a movement of people, pathway to change. So how can we as community be preparing ourselves, be trimming our wicks, ready to make change? How can we use our people power, not just for good, but for change. When the Master gives us resources, will we be smart with them and proactively use them? Not for the defence of the church, but to be the church. So this is talking about the parable of the talents. So this is where the Master has given out resources, and we have to ask ourselves, what will we do with them? And I think the motivation of the last servant who just buried his treasure is revealing. He was afraid of the landowner. His fear drove him to protect rather than prosper. And we see that in campaigning all the time. The fear is actually a terrible motivator for collective progress. Fear or shock can be used as an awakening tool, but it doesn't necessarily generate the action we want. In fact, fear is a great stopper of progress. So other campaigns that want to stop progress will use fear very commonly. It prevents change, it erodes trust, and it leads to self-protection. As we have all witnessed with the recent referendum result. Broadly speaking, I feel like this is the state of the church, that we've bunkered down. We've gone into self-protection in some ways. I'm not necessarily talking about this congregation, but the church more broadly. We have our little and diminishing talent, and our instinct is to hold onto it tighter. But I believe we have a duty to be courageous, to take risks that prioritise the formation of the new and different, not just protect the existing and familiar. And the final parable of this series of three reveals the destination point of the series, the purpose of why we need to be strategic, why we need to get organised, why we need to be proactive and courageous. The whole point is to be addressing injustice and caring for the victims of it. This is what we do in our active waiting. This is what it means to be bringing the end into the now. In an eschatological twist, the Son of Man arrives to give the final judgment everyone has been actively waiting for and says, well, actually, I have been here the whole time. I am the hungry, I am the thirsty, I am the naked, I am the prisoner, but you did not recognise me. And what I think is unique to our congregations is that I think we do recognise Jesus in these places, in these people. I think, we, unlike many other congregations perhaps, I think we're better at understanding that the parable three, I think we get that one. I think it's actually the lessons of parable one and two that I hear the challenge more clearly. Maybe we're not so good at that. Maybe we need to think about how we can turn our understanding of parable three into being proactive, courageous, in order to achieve it. How do we do that better? Are we putting in the preparation? Are we getting organised to be able to properly address the issues that break our hearts, that exasperate and enrage us? I don't want to wring my hands anymore and just send an occasional donation to TIA. I will keep doing that, but that's not all I want to do. I want to be using my time and energy on doing what will actually make the changes that are needed for the sake of the families who can't afford rent at the moment, for the kids locked up 22 hours a day in Banksia Hill, for the whole planet breaking yet more temperature records. We have been given the talents. We have the voice. We are the privileged. We have power to play a strategic role in creating change. I have also been, up until recently, the chair of the WA branch of ARC, the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change. And they're a unique little group of people. But whenever they turn up to an event, where there's been environmental movements in active for a long time that have been working hard trying to raise awareness about climate, and then the religious folk rock up. It's a relief. It's such a joy that everybody else feels, knowing that this group of people who are not the usual suspects, who bring a different tone, who bring a different weight to the debate, to the protest, whatever it is, to the action, it changes the dynamic and it changes the strength of the movement. And I think that's what we need to bring. We have a responsibility to add our voice, to bring a different tone, to bring a different perspective that's rooted in our long history, our long traditions, our prayerfulness, our groundedness, that we are called from who we are as Christians in following Christ to do these actions. And it's powerful. We can't be dismissed as easily as the ratbag activists that might usually be there, but we need to become a different version of those ratbag activists, I think. I think we are called to that. For me, it's what it means to be the church. So I would like to offer an invitation to walk together. I think our congregations need to connect better. I think there's a bunch of people like us out there that are a bit disconnected, and we need to find ways of continuing this conversation, of actively waiting together, of preparing ourselves in a way to actually make a difference, to use our collective for better. So if that means coming along occasionally on a Sunday night, then please, you're most welcome to come along. Up to you what you want to do, but you're most welcome to connect any third Sunday of the month. But and perhaps I should also come more regularly here as well. Let me pray just to close. But I hope you hear my call. Let me say this in a prayer. Dear God, help us to be active in waiting, in hoping, and active in bringing about your kingdom here on earth. Thank you that you are with us and you're with those who are suffering when we are yet to be able to make a change. Help us to be part of that change. Help us to honestly critique ourselves, to continually self-reflect on what it means to be the church and how we can be better at being that. To be offering a bold, fresh perspective on what it actually means to follow Christ. That's actually not new at all, it's very old. Help us to remember ourselves. Thank you for the faithfulness that is present here, that has abided within this community. And by your Spirit, may you enliven us all, that we may see the church be fully itself for the sake of those who need it most. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen.